Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome to episode whatever it is. I've stopped counting. But it's the first of
2022.
We made it this far. We got through last year.
It's gone.
Yeah.
It's history.
See what you did there? Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just have to endure a little bit more. Yeah. And then maybe some more after that. And then we're going to be okay. It's going to be fine.
40 years later into the podcast, and we're like, just one more year. It's just one more year, people. What's it to you?
I don't think podcasts, there'll be some new medium we'll be doing and we'll probably be appearing.
Holograms.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Will be holograms in people's living rooms. They're like, please, no.
I'd be like, oh, they got a piano over here. Let me play it. Cling, 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 cling. What is it? But I'd be getting all the keys wrong.
Or is it chopsticks as well? You know, and yeah, that'll just be okay. Okay, hi everyone.
What's up? Happy New Year to you, each and every one of you.
Yeah. We want to say big thanks to everyone who has rated the podcast on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts, mm-hmm. It needs to be said, but Spotify have just started allowing people to rate the podcast, and we've gotten all 5-star ratings, and it's super sweet.
And thank you, and love.
We really do. Really, I'm going to, you know that my love is harder to buy than fees.
Hey.
You say it in every episode. We love you. And I'm like, as a friend, a friend.
I know.
But I'm actually starting to develop real feelings now for the listeners.
I got my heart on my sleeve, man.
Yeah. I'm starting to feel feelings that are adjacent to.
Are you feeling
like
the love tonight?
No, I do. I love you guys. I do. There, I said it. I said it. Oscar's in the room.
What's up, Oscar?
Oscar's in the house. Yeah, he's just particular. I should just cut his nails, but I don't want to do that.
Nah, but you know, he likes to paint. You like to paint them. I mean, you sent me a picture one day of a cat with painted nails.
Oh, I did. I thought you were
nails.
Yeah,
but not dogs.
Yeah, I don't think I'd actually do it because he would not like it. I feel like he presents as very masculine, so I just don't think. Well, I say that, but he's wearing a little bow and whatever. But
he's a handsome little man.
Okay, so what have you got for... We're just going to dive straight in.
We're diving, all right. Well, I have the actually corner today, and I have my topic. So I'm just going to throw the old actually out there.
Actually.
And, you know, tribute to Claire, because actually. Okay, so there's this common misconception, of course, and this is a common one, that the pyramids were built by slaves. Well, what's been proven is that slaves didn't build the pyramids of Egypt.
I'm going to stop you right there. We're sourcing our misconceptions from the same page.
Cool.
Because mine last week was going to be that. And then I was like,
oh,
I changed it to whatever the other one was. But yeah.
I just thought it was a nice.
You're like, no, this is the source is my brain.
Yeah.
All my knowledge.
It's been there since
like,
I read
shut up, Claire. But yeah, no, we've been reading the same pages. anyway, continue.
The ancient Greek historian Herodotus once described the pyramid builders as slaves, propagating what became a global myth. Workers were likely poor people, but they were respected.
Respect.
Pointed out by archaeologists who found their graves around or even inside the pyramids, which is amazing, you know, to think about. I never would have thought that. And basically, there's no way they would be respected enough to be buried as slaves there.
True.
So they probably worked for a wage.
They dug their own graves then, when you think about it.
Well, that's like dark.
Build your grave.
Oof.
There's your grave.
Mm.
Yeah. Maybe build myself a pyramid.
Oh, God. Imagine you're like...
I feel like it's the right amount of extra. Yeah, imagine.
If you go out there and build my pyramid. Oh, and also another myth regarding the pyramids is that they haven't changed since their construction. Initially, the Great Pyramids were covered with white limestone plated with gold. That outer coating has since washed away. Where did all that gold go?
Oh, man.
In the wind. It's just floating.
It's floating there, waiting to be found.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chase the wind, people. You might get lucky.
I do have a particular girl for Egyptian history.
The old Egyptians.
It's really interesting.
It's amazing. Those people, that civilization was incredible. There's a great game out there, Assassin's Creed. I think it's Origins, I think.
Oh, which
one with Egypt.
Yeah. There's also a city building game called the one that, well, there's Civilization, which is amazing, but there's also the one that I love, even though it's like, oh god, I played the master of, it's Zeus, Master of Olympus, but there's, they have a pharaoh one as well, and it's really good. It's really good. It's fun.
And you get to be the pharaoh?
No, you just get to build like cities and stuff. It's fun. Cool. I think it's fun.
Did you name your city?
I did play the fair one, but I play the Greek one more, but you don't get to name the city. You get to name yourself as leader, though.
Cool.
Yeah.
I hope you were a nice leader. Imagine you had the option just to smite all your people.
Well, okay. You can be an awful leader, that's the thing, goodness. But then you don't want to do that either. It doesn't bode well for you. That's okay, awful. What do you got?
What have I got? Okay, so in order to open up my topic for today's podcast, I would like you to consider the following subject. Hybrid animals.
Oh, yay, I'm excited.
So have you ever heard of them? Can you name any, you know?
Like ligers, like yeah. That kind of thing. Okay, yeah, like I know ligers. Then I know, like, aren't mules, like, aren't they hybrid? Aren't they like a donkey and a horse or something?
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
But okay. It has to be, like, one has to be male and, you know, the biological sex of the animal matters because is a liger like a female, like a female tiger and, like, a male lion or something? Yeah, like same that, with a mule. Yeah. I think.
It's crazy. Like, if you can mix up any two animals, and then, what would you mix?
What would I mix?
If you could just mix any two animals, no matter what, let's just say it's beyond science here. It's just all
like a really fluffy dog and a bunny rabbit, probably.
I'd mix a turtle and, like, I don't know, a cat.
Okay, that's better. Mine is just cute factor, but yeah, yours is like
adorable. Mine's
yours
just
is mutant factor, it's, which I like.
You know, a cattle. You get it. No. It's terrible, I'm sorry.
That's, I would have said it.
A tat?
I was going to say a turtle, but that's...
A
turtle? A turtle. My brain is just not with it this evening. I'm like, wait a minute, turtle already exists.
As you can tell already, so my topic's going to be fairly bizarre.
Okay.
So I accidentally came across this particular topic online and I dove a little deeper into it. And purely out of curiosity, but also out of sheer horror. So heads up for people here. This is all scientific. There's nothing, you know, what would I say? Inappropriate, maybe. But, like, it's all science, okay? It's science, people. It's science. Horrible, horrible science. So once upon a time, okay, in history, there was a man by the name of Ilya Ivanovich Ivanov. So we'll call him Ivanov, right? And Ivanov was born in Shchedrigory Kirshgubernia in Russia in 1870.
The Creep Dive actually did this.
What?
Yeah, they did.
Did they?
It's really funny, yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Okay. Now, he grew up to be an established man, having graduated from Kharkiv University in 1896 and becoming a full-time professor there in 1907. You know, good for him. Good established career.
Good man,
Good man Ivanov. Yourself. And he would go on to become a researcher in the, you know, thanks for the information, Wikipedia, Askania Nova Natural Reserve, also for the State Experimental Veterinary Institute and for the Central Experimental Station for researching the reproduction of domestic animals and for the Moscow Higher Zootechnic Institute, all during his life. Okay, all during his career. In short, he was a fully fledged Russian Soviet biologist. All right. Now, at the turn of the 20th century, he would go on to perfect artificial insemination and its practical usage for horse breeding. He proved that the technology that he developed allowed one stallion to fertilize up to 500 mares instead of 20 to 30 by natural fertilization. The results were sensational for their time, and Ivanov Station was frequented by horse breeders from all around the world.
Wow.
Yeah, good for him again, you know. Good job.
That is
good
a
job.
Busy horse.
Yeah.
Just imagine the horse wearing medallions and, like,
just like
hair gel.
Just the chad, like
a low, yeah, chad, just a low V, rocking a low V. I think
got his little polo shirt on. Do you remember that thing that guys had going on where they pop their collars? Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I did a bit of popping the collar too. It was really in. We used to wear those kind of jerseys, and yeah,
they had a white collar on them. Yeah,
yeah. And I did
times.
A bit of popping the collar. It
good
was
times.
You weren't cool unless you popped the collar. So
yeah, you just weren't in. You know what I'm saying? You weren't popping. But the problem with Ivanov is that his research was not limited to horse breeding. Okay, through artificial. This is wrong.
It gets bad. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, he's using artificial insemination. You think he's only using it for horses, but see, Ivanov liked to crossbreed species in his research. He was the first researcher or biologist or perhaps crazy man to crossbreed a donkey and a zebra, for example, creating, you know, the zonkey or the zedonk. In fact, he had crossbred and created a guinea pig mouse. So he's kind of like Dr. Nick Revere in The Simpsons, you know, Mr. McGregor. You know,
yeah.
The guy with a leg for an arm and an arm for a leg. But he does about animals.
A guinea pig and a mouse.
Yeah, a guinea pig
a
mouse.
A mini.
T teeny tiny little guinea pig.
What would you call it? A mini or a gouse, I guess.
Gouse or a pouse or a gepouse. No, he's responsible for one of the worst proposals in crossbreeding experiments.
Mm-hmm.
See, this dude wanted to create something called a human Z. Can y'all guess what those two species might be?
I know that Jen and the Cream... Sorry, because we love her very, very much. Now that she calls it Orangiman.
Orangiman. Yeah. Human Z is the term I found online.
Or
so I was like,
Humanzee.
Humanzee. Or a Hape. No. No.
Or a Japan Man.
Or a Chupumanzee. No, it doesn't work
like
that. We just
need to stop.
Yeah, it's just going to go too far. But Ivanov first...
Or a Bonobro.
Fine, we're going to keep going with this. Okay. Okay, we're going to keep going. Wait now.
Oh no, my phone is ringing. Okay, it's on silent.
So Ivanov first put forward the idea of the human Z in 1910 at the World Congress of Zoologists in Graz, Austria. In his presentation, he claimed that it might one day be possible to create hybrids between humans and their closest relatives using artificial insemination. At the time, this notion was just speculation, but that would change after the Russian Revolution of 1917. So, in 1924, Ivanov put his proposals for a human-chimp hybridization experiment to the government at the time. And although the scientific community were not on board, Ivanov got both approval for his work and funding for a trip to Africa to collect apes. Documents indicate that the decision was pushed through by leading members of the Bolshevik government. So Ivanov set off for Africa in 1926 after first securing support of the Pasteur Institute, who ran a primate center in Guinea, then part of French West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
He reached Guinea in late March, but none of the institute's chimps were mature enough to breed. In November, Ivanov returned to Guinea to try again. Okay, I need to just brace myself for this. Despite his efforts, his experiments in French Guinea failed. None of the chimps conceived. However, this failure didn't shake his will to create a bonobro, as you call them.
Bonobro.
Human Z. And he came up with a new, more horrific idea, in which he aimed to fertilize a human female with the sperm from a male chimpanzee. So Ivanov headed home to Russia with the assortment of chimps to stock up a new ape nursery in the subtropical Soviet Republic of Abkhazia.
I mean, at least does the human woman know that she's...
Well, at least five women eventually volunteered for this bizarre experiment.
Okay, because like the poor little chimp girls didn't know that they were being...
It's pretty sad.
They didn't consent to that.
So yeah, five women put themselves forward. Humans. But the apes Ivanov had brought back did not flourish in the unfamiliar surroundings. And by 1929, when Ivanov was ready to proceed, the only adult male left was Tarzan, a 26-year-old orangutan. Who suffered from a brain hemorrhage and died.
Oh, poor Tarzan. So his name Tarzan as well. Like,
what shall we call this orangutan? Tarzan. Pick number two, my lord.
Poor Tarzan.
It's just the fact that he was a 26-year-old orangutan.
I love that this is just setting you off.
He should have been living his life, man. He should have been retired
at that stage.
His
yacht around the world, yeah, exactly.
Living the life, eating all those bananas.
Better justice for Tarzan. Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's set the trend. So new apes were about to arrive at the facility in 1930, but before they could, Ivanov fell victim to the widespread purge of Soviet scientists and was exiled to Kazakhstan. Although he was released the following year, he remained in exile in Kazakhstan and died of a stroke in 1932. So Soviet attempts to create a human-chimpanzee hybrid died with him. Thank heavens for that. Otherwise, who knows, we could have been like, you know, living in some Planet of the Apes.
I was going to say that is just a Planet of the Apes situation.
Definitely.
That no. We don't want and no. Is just no.
No, we don't want no Caesars.
It's just a large no.
But he was obviously a very controversial you know, researcher and scientist and biologist. And although he couldn't fulfill his dream of human's ease, some would say that his experiments change or challenge the laws of nature by creating animal hybrids that were never seen before. So just a few facts about this man.
Mm-hmm.
When Ivanov approached the Soviet government to fund his experiment, he came up with a strong tactic to convince the Bolshevik
leaders. Sorry, I'm just imagining him with like a little, you know, like in the Dragon's Den, the way they have like a flip chart.
Yeah.
And he just has all these pictures of like...
It's like human diagram. It's like the outline of a chimpanzee and the outline of a human, yeah, and a plus sign in the, yeah, middle and an equals. And it's just like...
Or just like a PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. He's got some really good, you know, design skills. Yeah. And a few stars bursting, yeah, through in each
transitions.
Turn. Yes. It's all about transitions.
Just like a human-y face.
Mm. What colour scheme would he use? Bit of purple?
I think he... Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Mm. But basically, yeah, he approached the Bolshevik leaders about his idea. And basically, he was aware of the anti-religious sentiment that the Bolshevik government promoted to weaken the hold of religious leaders and clerics at that time.
Uh-huh.
So therefore, he presented the Human Z experiment before the Academy of Sciences as a way to validate Darwin's theory that suggested that humans originated from apes. He proposed that if he proved Darwin right, then it would be a very big blow to the staunch forces of religion.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, although Ivanov's experiments, including his work on the human Z's, was soon forgotten, you know, when the story of the attempt to create the human Z was revealed in the Russian archives in the 1990s, they made headlines again, and Ivanov was referred to as the Red Frankenstein of the Soviet era. This news also gave rise to speculations in the media suggesting the presence of secret societies and evil experiments to create monsters during the Soviet period. Conspiracy theorists have suggested that Soviet ruler Joseph Stalin was interested in creating a powerful ape-man army and supported Ivanov's human Z idea. There is no evidence for this. I just think it's so funny, just a human ape army.
I mean, again, Planet of the Apes. So yeah. He's just like, yeah.
Joseph Stalin just sitting there chilling with his moustache.
Take your paws off me, you dirty ape. I don't know,
another motive that has been suggested is that the Bolsheviks who supported Ivanov were interested in applying his work to the field of eugenics in the hopes of breeding the perfect Soviet worker for the future. Perhaps to speed up the spread of desirable traits, such as a willingness to work communally. Again, though, there is no evidence for this.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, I would highly encourage all listeners who have pondered or are considering a career in the crossbreeding of humans and, you know, apes, to take a gawk at the film Planet of the Apes so that they make the right choices in life. Don't play God, people.
Was he just having the crack? Was he just like, I wonder what it would be like if I... You know, like I imagine some gardeners are like, what it would be like if I crossed like a rose with a tulip,
yeah,
or whatever.
And
he's like, I'm going to cross-pollinate. But
like, I think that if I was him, I would have
was charging, but it is not.
I think that if I was him, I would, I'd like.
Oh my God, that was so loud. I was trying to be subtle.
That's all right. We just got to do our charging.
My ballet career did not take off.
Is this your charger?
Yeah, it is.
Just put it around here.
Because I am not able to be delicate or...
like, okay, y'all just listen to the sound of my voice. I'm just saying that I would totally crossbreed a dinosaur and, like, my mom.
Okay.
I think, you know, what dinosaur would I cross my mom with?
The visual of your mother. I'm kind of imagining...
Like, you know, Godzilla.
Godzilla. Roar. That's, yeah, exactly,
but
what I imagined.
Instead of Godzilla, it's Mamzilla. Or a Mamosaurus Rex.
Or a Velociraptor.
Marion. Ratmamp. Raptor. Marion Raptor.
But these are really bad.
Like, I mean, I'm just saying that's what I would do. If I had the power to crossbreed anything, it'd be a dinosaur and mamp.
Okay, but what part of, like, how is this going to look? Your mom's head.
Yeah. And then the rest is just a T-Rex body.
Okay.
And she's just...
So she just has her normal... But you've taken basically the T-Rex's most deadly thing, which is its teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
she can't harm anybody.
Essentially totally impotent, so it just has the useless little T-Rex hands.
Yeah. Swing her tail around.
But that's, like, it doesn't have any... It's just your mom's face.
Well,
then.
It's either that or a pterodactyl. Imagine Mam is a pterodactyl.
I think you meant pterodactyl.
What's a pterodactyl?
I have no idea.
Oh, did I make that up?
No, because pterodactyl is spelled with a silent P in the beginning.
Oh, yes, I did it. That's right, everyone. I'm still an English teacher. Boom. Thank you.
I could be a pterodactyl because I'd be able to fly. I'd still be cool, but I'd have like my own face, maybe.
You'd have that real scream, you know, in the sky. Of, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't because...
Mam would.
Yeah, your mam would. Okay, that was a really weird
story. That was a disturbing story, but it was fun. I apologise. It's just mad to know there are some freaks out there in history, you know what I'm saying?
I suppose, yeah, when it comes to biology, like, people do think along these lines, but it's the ethics of it that you have to consider, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've made so much noise. I'm so sorry to listeners of this podcast. I can't move without knocking something over. There's so many things around me that I'm just like...
She's doing this for you. Just remember that. You know what I'm saying?
I am. She's doing it for you. What else I'm going to do for you is I am going to talk about some historically inaccurate movies, but also talk about some historically accurate movies. Excellent. And I got this idea because we've had some holidays and I've been doing my work. But in between doing work, I've sat down to catch up on a couple of movies and some films I watch out of like interest. Others I'm like, I'll throw this on the background, whatever. Like Dirty Dancing last night.
What a jam.
I'm just not going to have anything negative said about that movie because, yes, I know it's lame. Yes, I know it's cheesy. But I love it so much.
Grey is so pretty.
She's so pretty in it. The blonde dance instructor.
Yeah.
Is just so beautiful. Like, it's insane. It's just, and Swayze. I mean, Swayze is at his most, like, Swayze, really. He's just beautiful in it. It's just a great movie. Yeah, it's lovely. Soundtrack too is just like... killer. But what I did watch over Christmas was Braveheart, because it's on, I don't know, whichever one of the streaming services, and I was watching it and I was like, Braveheart is very entertaining, it has to be said, it's really, really entertaining, but man, is it historically inaccurate. And I don't even, it's not a period of history I know that much about, but I know enough about it to be like, like, there's what I did is I compiled a list of films that are historically inaccurate. I suppose as viewers, we need to be careful between the difference between, I suppose, using these films as a source of, like, historical knowledge or just seeing them as entertainment. And Braveheart is, while some parts of it have some basis in history, like, if you were using that to learn about Scottish history or, you know, English history, whatever, you would be so off base. Which isn't surprising given that it's Mel Gibson who like directed it. It's not going to be,
he's a bit up his own, you know.
Well, like, he's done this in a couple of like a few of his movies,
We Were Soldiers,
The Patriot is another really good example, or even Apocalypto. There's parts of that that are like, you know, quite historically inaccurate as well. So, but I'm going to focus on Braveheart for now. And I have a couple of other really, really good ones as well. So Braveheart, the first thing, the title, Braveheart was actually believed to have not even been William Wallace's, like, sobriquet or, like, nickname. It was actually assigned to Robert the Bruce. Robert the Bruce does appear in the film. William Wallace was a real person. We know that much. We don't know much about him. We know a little bit more about Robert the Bruce. What I can say is that William Wallace definitely didn't impregnate the future Queen Consort of England, Isabella, in the film. So Isabella in the film is kind of, you know, that he kind of seduces her. And then at the end of the movie, she whispers to the dying Edward Longshanks that she's, you know, your bloodline will die with you or whatever he
it
says.
It is satisfying, though.
It is. And he's like, I was thinking this when I was watching, I was like, just ask for a piece of paper and write it down. Like, kill that hoe.
Yeah.
Just write it down. Now, because she was only 3 at the time that they met in the film, she was 3 years of age. So it's unlikely, to say the least.
Yeah.
Another thing that is meant to infuriate Scots, actually, when they watch it, even though, like, it's brought a lot of tourism to Scotland, it's done a lot of good for Scotland, is the wearing of kilts in the film. So the kilts are hundreds of years too early. So they were not wearing kilts at this time.
But what were they wearing?
Well, not kilts. one of the biggest things, and this is for me, this is just unforgivable, but Mel Gibson made the point that, like, it would have been really hard to shoot this. One of the most famous battles is the Battle of Stirling. He calls it Stirling in the film, but historically, and it's a really famous battle in history, it's with the Battle of Stirling Bridge. But in the movie, there's no bridge. And there should be, because the most famous thing about that battle is that it was fought on a bridge. It is. It's a great scene. And it is, even though, like, again, there would have been far more military strategy planned by the English as well, and even the Scottish. But the fact that there's no bridge is just a little bit, like, it's because it's so famously called the Battle of Stirling Bridge. But Mel Gibson did make the point that, like, it would have been really, really hard to film it and to stage it and all that. Fair enough. But at the same time, I mean, come on, Mel.
Try a little harder.
Yeah. The other thing that really bothers, so if there's listeners listening to this who are not from the UK or Ireland, you might not really recognise the accents in the film. Mel Gibson does an okay effort at speaking with a Scottish accent. A lot of the main actors, if I do that one more time, I'm going to knock the microphone off the table. I keep elbowing a clothes rack behind me. It's like, she means it. She's scary. The accents in it range from real, genuine Scottish accents mm-hmm. to, but a lot of Irish actors were used in it, and particularly some Northern Irish actors. Mm. So, like, some of the accents are so, they're not Scottish, they're Northern Irish. We can hear it. We can hear the major difference. There is a huge similarity in a Northern Irish and Scottish accent, mostly because a lot of the Northern Irish people are descendants of Scottish settlers that came over during the plantations. But, like, it's hundreds of years later, we can hear the difference in the accent. I think Mel Gibson probably just didn't recognise it and was like, fine, but over here it sounds a bit bonkers. Mm-hmm. I think it would probably sound to Americans like a Canadian playing like a Southern gentleman or something. Yeah. You know, it just sounds wrong. It sounds a little bit different. So that's Braveheart. There is so much more, but I wanted to focus on other films as well because some of these are just so bad. The second one on my list, I think, is probably the worst, the worst of them, which is their most recent, I think it was 2001, Pearl Harbor.
Oh my God.
Starring Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett.
It's Michael Bay, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Michael Bay. I don't even know where to start. I suppose, again, they do the thing. A lot of things on my list, you'll notice a couple of things that these films have in common, and one of those things is love stories that it's done in Braveheart and it's done here in Pearl Harbor. There tends to be love stories inserted into the narrative to try and make them more emotive, maybe more captivating, more interesting to audiences, but a lot of the time it actually serves to draw away from the historical accuracy. In Pearl Harbor, I mean, it's terrible. It's a terrible film. It's not even entertainingly bad.
I actually watched it a few weeks ago. Just the start of it is just so cheesy. It's like
the script is
the kids take. Yeah, it's just he's like, yeah. Oh God, no, can't go into
probably that. The most unforgivable thing is it is FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, of course, gives a speech and he gets out of his wheelchair. So he like stands up and it's this big palaver. He's trying to prove a point about like resilience and strength and all of this. When in reality, FDR was extremely secretive about his disability and he went to great lengths to conceal it. So like he did not want people knowing. FDR had polio is the usual explanation, although there's a lot of research lately to suggest that it might have been something else, but polio is what we'll go with. And he did not want people knowing this. He didn't, because he thought at the time, whereas today a politician might use it as like a source of sympathy, that would have sickened him. And he really just didn't want people seeing it as like a weakness at all. So he was at great pains to conceal his disability. There is no way that he would have stood up out of his wheelchair. It also reminds me of Krusty. Do you remember The Simpsons? He's like, Eleanor, and he gets up out of the wheelchair and he's like, oh, that's right. It's so funny. There is a good film, 1970 film Tora Tora Tora, which is far superior account of Pearl Harbor, because it was a joint venture between the US and Japan.
Cool.
So what you get out of that is you get both sides and that's what history should be, rather than these really ultra nationalist kind of overly patriotic tellings of events. It's really irritating. The next one on my list is a Disney cartoon, but I think it's worth talking about because she was a real historical figure, and that is Pocahontas.
Oh, I thought you were going to Mulan.
No. So Pocahontas, she did exist, but very, very, very differently to in the film. So John Smith existed as well, but they didn't actually have a romantic relationship whatsoever. She did marry an Englishman called John Rolfe, and she, when she married him, she took the English name Rebecca Rolfe, so she became known as Rebecca Rolfe. She moved to England with him, And they bore a son, Thomas. But she died in Gravesend in Kent at the age of 20 or 21, because her birth year is kind of contested, in 1617. So she died very, very young. And it's not as...
She wasn't talking to her granny in a tree.
No, it's not as... She's not at all as portrayed as in the film, and they just don't include John Rolfe, who was significantly older than her as well, by the way.
That's problematic.
So yeah, it's just this kind of romanticisation of it as well. That's quite offensive too. The next one on the list is, even though, again, it's a great film, is Gladiator. Yeah. There's a lot of historical inaccuracies in Gladiator, but again, I suppose Ridley Scott, the whole point is entertainment. So the film, kind of towards the beginning of the film, Marcus Aurelius is murdered by his son, Commodus. That did not happen in real life. He died of chickenpox, which is less...
That's very...
Entertaining.
Underwhelming.
Yeah. It's kind of just a...
It's kind of messed up chickenpox.
Yeah. Now, Commodus, Emperor Commodus, played by, brilliantly, to be fair, by Joaquin Phoenix. Although I feel like he does ham up the role a bit, but it works. It's kind of campy, but it works. He's kind of like textbook villain. But yeah, I think he's great. And we know he's a great actor because Joker, hello. He was pretty terrible. Commodus was pretty terrible. But again, he didn't die in the way that's portrayed in the film. He was strangled in the bath by a guy called Narcissus. Oh. Narcissus was his wrestling partner. That is not a euphemism. I was writing this earlier and I was like, his wrestling partner just sounds like...
It's like,
what are they doing? They're wrestling, sweetie. No, he was like his personal trainer kind of thing. And how this happened is Commodus had a concubine, he had a mistress. And she was reading a list of people that Commodus was planning on executing. And she was on the list. And she was like, oh, hell no. So she poisoned him. But Commodus didn't, he got really, really drunk, but he didn't die. So she was like, oh, just go strangle him in the bath, there, Narcissus. And he did. And that's how he died.
Wow.
Now, I'm going to segue a little bit here because, you know, again, it's what I do. He was a total jerk, Commodus. Like, that's fair in the film, the portrayal of him. He was just bonkers. I'm going to take this off Wikipedia because this is really funny. It's not, it's okay. You're going to be like, what the hell is funny about this? But I just... Commodus was a skilled archer who could shoot the heads off ostriches in full gallop and kill a panther as it attacked a victim in the arena. Okay, so imagine just an ostrich galloping and its head would just explode. Citizens of Rome missing their feet through accident or illness were taken to the arena where they were tethered together for Commodus to club to death while pretending they were giants. That's like horrific. Okay. Now, this is also awful. For each appearance in the arena, he charged the city of Rome $1 million sesterces or sesterces, straining the Roman economy. He decapitated a running ostrich with a specially designed dart. And afterwards, he carried his sword and the bleeding head of the dead bird over to the senator's seating area. And he motioned as though they were next.
Oh God.
Dio notes that the targeted senators actually found this more ridiculous than frightening and chewed on laurel leaves to conceal their laughter.
Wow.
Okay. On other occasions, Commodus killed 3 elephants on the floor of the arena by himself and a giraffe. I'm sorry. I know. I like that he's trying to flex by killing. I'm just imagine strangling the giraffe. Like, I imagine him doing like one of those like wrestling moves, proper, you know, like the armbar or something.
And Walls just, of Jericho.
Giraffe. And he's just like, yeah. And everyone's like kind of clapping. Like half clapping, but they don't really know how to react. They're like, ah, go Commodus.
Oh my God. This is horrific. Like, as in, I'm thinking about the guys, the senators just chilling there eating those leaves. My students probably eat those.
Trying not to laugh.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, pretending to be scared.
Yeah.
The next movie. Now, to be fair, this isn't, like, it is clearly a film made for entertainment purposes, but there is some historical inaccuracies in it that if you're basing your knowledge of ancient Greece or ancient Rome on these movies, you need to just not do that. The next one is 300. Great film.
Gosh, yeah.
Great film, but, my favourite thing in it is, and this is something that every time I've watched it with someone, they've always pointed this out, like the Spartan army would have had more armour than just skirts. They're basically just all topless, wearing like capes and skirts. And you're like, okay, I mean, you all look amazing. You're fair play. You're doing your, you know, you're doing your squats.
They're the real fraternal
kind
of chads. You know what I mean? The real
my God,
fraternity.
My next line, I'd actually written that it was, they walked so that frat boys could run.
Yeah.
So that you could go to your like frat parties and be like, I'm dressed as a Spartan, even though they look nothing like that.
Like a really good body.
Yeah. And just... this is how I just show it off every Halloween. Exactly.
Wow.
Okay. So lots of different things. I mean, but I'm going to focus on the, because this is a, I was going to do the Spartans on their own as a topic because they are fascinating.
I always laugh at the, who's the Persian king?
Oh, is it Xerxes or Darius? It's one of them, yeah.
Xerxes, so sorry.
Yeah, the way he's portrayed as well. So in the movie, they call the Athenians boy lovers. Now, that's a reference to pederasty. So pederasty obviously was practiced in ancient Greece. If anybody who doesn't know what that is, pederasty in ancient Greece, it was a socially acknowledged romantic relationship between an older male, he was called the Erastes, and a younger male who was called the Eromenos, apologies, who was usually in his teens. Now, we look at this and we're like, oh God, ew. And there's, see, I have spent ages researching this over the last few weeks because it's just, it's super interesting. If not really, really disturbing, but it's super, super interesting. And there's so many different takes. Did it exist at all? Most historians would say, yes, it absolutely did. It did exist. It's just, how was it viewed in contemporary society? Did they look at it and kind of go like, you know, was it a taboo? Was it widely socially acceptable? Was there consent involved? All this sort of stuff. But there seems to be no straight answer here. What probably is true is that it was practiced in Sparta as well. So those Spartans in the movie would have been doing it as well, which is pretty gross, but okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, it changes how I view 300.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This isn't the last one. It's the third last on my list. The Patriot. So the Patriot is this like, again, Mel Gibson. Oh my God.
He's everywhere, man.
He's just everywhere. Obviously, yeah, portraying kind of colonial times and just before the American War of Independence. It's coming from an Irish person watching the British portrayed as the villains. We're like, OK, that's fine, because in history, a lot of the time, yeah. But in terms of the Redcoats in the US being as horrific as they are portrayed in The Patriot, highly unlikely. You know, there's like a kid murdered, for God's sake. Like, it's highly, highly unlikely. The guy that Mel Gibson plays as well in the film, or he's based on.
Okay.
He's based on a real life American who was meant to be like just this horrifically racist, like apparently supposed to have like enslaved and like raped like Native Americans things. So again, you're getting one side of a story that is incredibly nationalistic and like emotive for entertainment purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point of the films that I've listed there, like The Patriot, Braveheart. They're all emotive and nationalistic. That's the point of them. And that those films are rarely historically accurate because history isn't always just completely one-sided unless you're talking about Nazis.
Yeah.
That's like the only time that it's acceptable.
Agreed.
Okay. Very briefly going to mention Marie Antoinette, directed by Sofia Coppola. I'm a big fan of her. Old Sophia, apart from her appearance in The Godfather Part 3, which is possibly the worst acting performance by anybody ever.
She
I mean, her dad was the director. It's really bad. Mm. It's really bad. And she's a great director. She's a fantastic director. Lost in Translation. I mean, she's amazing. In Marie Antoinette, it stars Kristen
Dunst.
Yes. And she is a great actress as well. Visually, it is stunning. It is so beautiful. But that's where the historical accuracy kind of ends. There is a scene in it apparently where you can spot somebody wearing a pair of Converse under their dress.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah. I was actually looked that up. I have to double check that.
Did they have her say let them eat cake in it?
I think they did. Yeah.
That just makes it worse.
Yeah, it's does. Like it does. No, I'll have to look that up because I'm not entirely sure. But I think she said that in the film.
Oh, for God's sake.
The last one I want to mention is, even though it's based on a true story, the end of it has always just gotten me. And even as a kid, I was a bit like, huh. The Sound of Music. So The Sound of Music is based on the real life Van Trapp family.
Wait, they were real?
Oh, yeah, they were real. They were a real singing family. Yeah. And the whole thing happened that she was, you know, she was.
Oh, my God.
She was hired as a governess and they fell in love and all of that. And it's all lovely. But
oh, my God, I did not know that.
At the end of the film where they escape and they're kind of like walking over the Alps.
That's a hard walk, I'm telling
into
you.
Into Switzerland. Mm-hmm. In real life, they got a train.
Okay, that makes sense.
But also because somebody pointed out, especially where the film is set, that at the end of the film, if they're heading anywhere, they seem to be walking towards Germany. So I just keep imagining them twirling like down the mountains, like freedom.
Right, it's
like
Nazi's arms.
Yeah. So the end of that film has always troubled me a little bit, but look, those panned shots of them going over the mountains, like, oh, it's amazing. It is beautiful. It is one of those films
that.
How long
does that walk for? Like, how much food did they have, or water?
They didn't seem to have
clothes?
Any food, actually.
Yeah, they must be starving.
Especially with the chubby little girl, like, she wasn't going very far. I'm telling you that now.
No.
She's so cute.
She's adorable.
She is so cute.
She's adorable. So basically, they were walking right up to Nazi Germany. Cool.
Yeah.
But nobody knew until now. Oh my god.
Now, I decided to counteract all the historical inaccuracies in these movies with some movies that deserve to be lauded for their historical accuracy, mm-hmm. or for their attempts at least to be as historically accurate as possible. Mm-hmm. Now, the first film on my list was originally on my other list. It was on the inaccurate list, but I did a bit of research. I did a bit of digging, and I found that actually what I thought was inaccurate might actually be accurate, and that film is Titanic.
Go on, Titanic.
We know that James Cameron went to like insane effort to keep it as accurate in so many ways, down to uniforms, down to the types of like ropes used apparently, and like really, really particular about little details like that. A lot of it is based, of course, on witness testimony. It is romanticised a little bit, you know, the band playing when the ship went down and all that sort of stuff. But you can understand that for kind of emotive value. So there is disagreement about this scene in question, which I think has been one of the most controversial scenes in the movie, and that is the suicide of the ship's first officer, William Murdoch. So Officer Murdoch in the film, he shoots somebody dead by accident. It's kind of a heated moment, mm-hmm. and then he shoots himself, and it's very sad. And his family complained about this because they were like, you know, he was a hero and this is really insulting. Mm-hmm. But it would seem that there may be some truth in this, that this might have actually happened. The person who said, so the one of the other officers on the ship was, I think he was the second officer, was Charles Lightoller. And Charles Lightoller said that he saw him get washed away. He wrote that in a letter to Murdoch's widow, but he later acknowledged that this was a lie. He didn't see this at all. So it's felt that he knew somebody, one of the officers did die by suicide. It's believed that most of the officers agree that one of them did die by suicide. One of them did shoot themselves. So it is believed that it was him, but that the family were spared the kind of, I don't know what you'd call, I suppose, the taboo of it at the time,
the stigma of it.
Yeah, yeah. This is an author writing with the Titanic. His name is Tim Moulton. He writes that although the evidence is circumstantial, which it is, of course, it does seem that an officer did shoot himself, and Murdoch seems the most likely candidate, as Titanic expert Bill Wormstedt and Tad Fitch point out, Murdoch was the man directly in charge of the ship in the hours leading up to the collision with the iceberg, and he was therefore responsible for the ship and all its passengers during that time. His career was effectively over, even if he survived the disaster.
Wow.
Now, it's not a nice scene to obviously include, especially implying that he murdered somebody before. But then again, that there's rumours that that happened as well. So we'll never know. We just won't know. Yeah. But when I was a kid, I thought that I did it again. I thought that scene was completely fabricated. So I was like, that's so insulting. But now I realise maybe not. Yeah, it has to just be pointed out that it is an incredibly accurate film in so many ways that it deflects a little bit with the love story, but that's okay because it's a great movie.
It's an amazing movie. We quote it quite a lot.
We do. I want to give an honourable mention to A Night to Remember here as well, another film about the Titanic disaster of 1958.
Mm-hmm. Very good, yeah.
It is brilliant, and there's no love story in that. It's kind of just, mm-hmm. So it's great. Next on my list, historically accurate films, the film Lincoln, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring the incredible Daniel Day-Lewis as the titular character. Okay, I think this is a really good example of the problem that filmmakers and directors face here, because I went to see Lincoln in the cinema. I was so excited to see it. Steven Spielberg is an amazing director, obviously. Daniel Day-Lewis is probably my favourite living actor. He's certainly up there. There Will Be Blood is just, it's just amazing. And we know he's going to be, you know, turn out an amazing performance. The film is beautiful in so many ways. And for me, a historian, seeing this, it's, I don't want to use the word boring because I think that's a bit insulting, but it's drawn out and it's not the most exciting. And that's where I think, while Spielberg was very, very true to, like, you know, to history, Daniel Day-Lewis, like, method acted, like, his voice, even as Lincoln, a lot of people found his voice quite odd and bizarre, but apparently, like, as accurate as possible. It's quite high-pitched if you've ever watched the film. But that's the issue. You can go for the entertaining aspect of it and maybe insert some poetic license, or you can endeavour to be as historically accurate as possible. Something is going to give either way. And in this instance, it might have been entertainment value. But then as a historian, I'm like, I shouldn't want to be entertained. I should want the truth, I guess.
Yeah.
But then
I
it's
agree.
A movie. So you're kind of like, oh, it's a tough one. It's a tough line to navigate. But I'm going to use another Steven Spielberg film here.
Jaws.
Based on a shark, yeah. Forever in our hearts. We miss you, man. We miss you, buddy.
Hashtag Jaws, R.I.P. Okay.
The film I was going to use here was Schindler's List.
Oh, God.
So your joke is just so inappropriate. I could not be using a sadder film here.
Oh, God.
Schindler's List is based on Oscar Schindler. There are elements of it that are probably exaggerated or romanticized and whatever. Why I think it needs to be included historically accurate is that its portrayal of the Nazis, if you look what I was saying there about the Patriot, the villain in the Patriot, the British guy, is so comic book evil that he's not believable. Yeah. He's not a believable human being. In Schindler's List, the Nazis are just portrayed so brilliantly because they're so boringly evil. They're terrible. They're frighteningly bad. But they're like, it's that a phrase that Hannah Arendt, the political theorist, she coined about the Nazis. She called it the banality of evil, how boring evil can be. Like when they're the Wannsee conference where the final solution was planned by like Adolf Eichmann, the most boring looking bureaucrat that you could ever find. And like in Schindler's List, there's this scene where, oh my God, there's like, now it's been years since I've seen Schindler. It's one of those films you can't watch very often because it's very, very hard, difficult to watch.
Very true.
But there is a scene where a Nazi is trying to shoot somebody and his gun jams. I'm not sure if it's his character or if it's another Nazi. But someone's gun jams and he's like, he gets kind of frustrated by it. And then he's like, eventually he gets it to work. But it's just such, it's a really like, that's someone's life. Like, it's just, but it, again, it just shows that they just didn't consider the Jews like human, you know. And there's a scene in it where he's like picking off camp inmates from his balcony and he just looks bloated and like bored. There's the scene where you know, the very famous train scene where they're all packed in and the guards are just standing on the platform looking like bored as well. And I think a portrayal of evil that way is so much more realistic than
it's
like
humane.
It does humanize them because they are humans and that's what is important. That we need to remember that, but also terribly evil people.
Apparently one of the survivors of that specific camp, when they met, I don't know that they meet Ralph Fiennes, but his character portrayal in it, he's based on obviously a real person.
A man goes,
there you go. And they said it was so uncanny, like it was so terrifyingly accurate that they were quite nervous to meet him, you know, as
an actor. It's a really hard, it's probably Ralph Fiennes' biggest, best performance,
terrifying.
But it's also awful. And he's horrific in it. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. But that's the point of the film. It's not an easy film to watch, of course. But it's just, it's brilliant. Related film to that I always show students because I think it's, again, really brilliantly historically accurate is Downfall. Downfall is brilliant.
Yeah.
The portrayal of Hitler by Bruno Ganz is just like, it has to be one of the best cinematic performances, I think, ever. Like, he just, and it must be a really draining thing for an actor to do, to get into a role like that.
Hitler, imagine method acting Hitler.
Yeah.
It's so dark,
there's a portrayal of the Goebbels family as well, which is incredible as well. The actors playing Magda and Joseph Goebbels are just incredible as well. But Downfall, to kind of portray the last days of these people's lives, but not make them sympathetic, is very, very difficult. But that's not what the director is doing. And actually, the fact that they, it nearly makes it worse. You know what I mean? It makes it worse. And the whole thing, it's brilliant. Now, to counteract all that kind of nationalist emotiveness of the other list, where we had stuff like The Patriot and Braveheart, and because it's very, very easy to, there's certain things you can do in cinema, I suppose, to like elicit reactions from your audience, and things like having an animal die in your movie or having a love story or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you're going to get those reactions. You're going to get strong emotive responses from your audience. That's going to make your film live on in infamy or whatever forever and immortalize it. So to take an event in history and to make it as visceral and as raw and as awful as possible, to me, is so much better. And I picked this movie, even though I'm so uncomfortable with it. And I've only ever watched it, I'd say, twice, maybe three times at a push, which is Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, gosh.
It's really hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it just takes the horror of the Vietnam War, and not even that, of just the military in general. It's just incredible. It's an incredible film, but it's so hard to watch. So like, it's dark. It's really, really dark. It points to the psychological trauma of being a soldier. I'm sure if you're a soldier or a veteran and you have experience in action, you'd watch this and be like, this is more, especially something like the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they reference things like the 1,000-yard stare. So like the 1,000-yard stare obviously is known for soldiers who've combat veterans who have like this, just after a certain amount of time in that you have to like just dissociate from your surroundings, so you develop this expression which is really blank. So it talked about that. I love the cons, and I think it's genius by Kubrick, who's again one of my favorite directors, the Rifleman's Creed. I love that they keep repeating it. I'm going to actually read it because I think it's really cool, even though it's kind of goes against everything I stand for as a pacifist. I just love it, and I love he reuses it so many times in the film. It becomes kind of a motif, and it's really cool. And it is, isn't it, while Pyle recites before that scene. So it's, "This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life. I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless. I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. My rifle and I know that what counts in war is not the rounds we fire, the noise of our bursts, nor the smoke we make. We know that it is the hits that count. We will hit. My rifle is human. Even as I, because it is my life. Thus, I will learn it as a brother. I will learn its weaknesses, its strengths, its parts, its accessories, its sights, and its barrel. I will keep my rifle clean and ready, even as I am clean and ready. We will become part of each other. We will. Before God, I swear this creed, my rifle and I are the defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviours of my life. So be it, until victory is America's and there is no enemy but peace." Okay.
Deep.
It's deep and it's dark, and it's just I think it's just great. I think again, it's the reality of war. It's not always this beautifully patriotic, like there's a real nihilistic kind of thing running through that film that I think is brilliant. I've saved my favourite two for last. This is really just a list of my favourite historical films. So to realise it's really self-centred, but I'm like, you're stuck listening to me. You can't go anywhere. People just turning it off. The last two, I think, really, really historically accurate films. The first is Spotlight. Spotlight, I went to see in the cinema as well. And it was really quiet. I think there was only like four people in there. Because you look at Spotlight, it doesn't look like the most entertaining film. You're not going to watch Spotlight and be like, it's entertaining. I think it's one of the greatest films of the last like 10 years because of how historically accurate it is and how it takes something so horrific, in this instance, child sex abuse in the Catholic Church, and turns it into something real, really real, and makes you really feel it. So I'm just reading this from the Wikipedia page for anyone who hasn't seen the film. The film follows the Boston Globe's Spotlight team. So the Spotlight team are the oldest continuously operating newspaper investigative journalist unit in the United States. So essentially they work in the Boston Globe and they're a team of investigative journalists. They were investigating cases of widespread and systemic child sex abuse in the Boston area by numerous Roman Catholic priests. Of course, Boston being a very heavily Irish Catholic area, it is based on a series of stories by the Spotlight team that earned the Globe the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. Now, the cast of the film is just incredible. It's an ensemble cast. So there's Mark Ruffalo, Michael Keaton, Rachel McAdams, John Slattery, Stanley Tucci. There's Brian D'Arcy James, Liev Schreiber, he's amazing, and Billy Crudup. So it's just like, it's incredible. But besides the fact that it has this stellar cast, it's harrowing. It's hard to watch. They tell the story. There's no like the insertion of anything emotive because it doesn't need to be made emotive. It already is. If you know anything about journalism or investigative journalism, it's really realistic. It starts, you know, as they start to unravel the story. There's this amazing scene where Mark Ruffalo just like explodes when he realizes that that the Catholic Church knew about this, and he screams like they let it happen, and it's just, oh, it's heartbreaking. It's one of his greatest performances. I think Mark Ruffalo is incredible in it. It's just a great film. I don't want to go too much into it because, one, it's probably a very triggering topic for a lot of people, but also because if you have the emotional capacity to, you should watch it. It is, I can't say enough amazing things about it. It will make you very angry. But it's also very important. It's important that it's watched for the victims. And it's so historically accurate that it is a teachable moment to watch that, you know. I've saved the best for last. I've saved one of my favourite films ever. Not only because it's just an incredible film, but because, again, it's in terms of historical accuracy, in terms of making an epic film about a really famous historical figure and just making it so true. I think that's really, really admirable. And the character is Jesse James. Now, Jesse James, that's the thing. Jesse James has been really romanticized in, especially in kind of Southern lore, because Jesse James was seen as kind of this like Robin Hood type figure coming out of the American Civil War. And this film doesn't romanticize him in the slightest, and it's just done really good. It's quite a dark film. Mm-hmm. The Assassination of Jesse James by the character Robert Ford. It's directed by Andrew Dominik, great director. I think it might have been his debut, actually. I'm not sure if it is his debut. It's like incredible. It's like, now it was a total box office bomb, but it's kind of received kind of like a cult following now because people are looking back and being like, hang on a minute, that was actually amazing. The problem was, at the time, there were so many amazing films released that year or in or around that time. There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men. It kind of got like left behind, but actually, oh my god, like, so the cinematography in it is some of the most beautiful cinematography I've ever seen in a film, because of course the cinematographer was Roger Deakins. Roger Deakins was nominated for an Oscar for it twice that year. He was nominated against himself, so he was also nominated for No Country for Old Men, so he was in that category twice. Wow. But he didn't win. The guy who did There Will Be Blood won. I can't remember his name now for the life of me. Roger Deakins is an amazing cinematographer. There are some scenes in that film that are so beautiful. The train scene, of course, is one of the most famous, with Brad Pitt's profile standing against the oncoming train. It's within the smoke. It's beautiful. There's another one where he's running his hand through like corn in a field, or wheat, against this blue sky. It's really beautiful. There are some just amazing scenes in that. The soundtrack is one of my favorite film soundtracks ever. So Nick Cave and Warren Ellis sampled quite a lot, but it's really beautiful. It's very relaxing. There's a little mix of kind of bluegrass in it and folk. It's gorgeous. The cast is amazing. Brad Pitt, personally, and this is a controversial take, this is a hot take, I think Brad Pitt's best performance of his entire career. I think totally underrated performance. Plays Jesse James with just like kind of sympathetic but not really, a hint of like darkness, and it's just brilliant the way he plays him. It's kind of vulnerable but not vulnerable. Casey Affleck, you hate to say it, but Casey Affleck is the star of the show, really, as Robert Ford. He did win an Oscar for the role, and deservedly so is Casey Affleck, might be a fairly problematic person, but he's just amazing in this film. Mm-hmm. Knocks Ben, the other Affleck, out of the water, I think, in terms of his acting skills.
Oh, if you think about Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. It depicts the last years of James's life as the James Younger gang that he was obviously a leading member of starting to fall apart. The Pinkerton agents are starting to catch up with him. He's becoming increasingly paranoid. Everything about it is accurate. The director Dominic and the guy who wrote the book Hansen that it's based on went to so much effort to get things right. There's narration obviously from the book in it as well. It's really beautiful. It's just really accurate. It's very long. I love it. It's like top three favourite films for me ever. Controversial because I know some people who absolutely hate it. I showed it to a class once. They thought it was the most boring film they'd ever seen. Oh. I don't think that at all. I think the storytelling in it is just incredible. The characterization is incredible. The everything about this film for me is perfect. But not just the accuracy of it is what makes it for me, and not romanticizing him as a folk hero, essentially, that he was a criminal, and but also that Robert Ford wasn't a hero for assassinating him either. So it's just brilliant.
Wow,
it's amazing. So those are some films now for you guys to go off and watch.
They're definitely taking those down. Definitely, well, I would be,
and they're gonna watch. The assassination of Jesse James and be like, that was really boring. It's not boring.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
It's not boring. Has Brad Pitt ever steered you wrong before? Has he been in a bad film? Legends of the Fall isn't great.
It's not too, yeah, actually.
Mm. Oh, wait, Troy.
Yeah, there we go.
Sorry, Brad. I nailed it. Troy's all right. It's all right. It's entertaining. I mean, watch it.
I'm trying to think of inaccurate films in terms of a historical context. I suppose Michael Collins or...
Well, actually, I was going to use Michael Collins as being very accurate. I think Michael Collins is quite accurate. There's a few things in it. I mean, the insertion of the Kitty he did, he was engaged to Kitty Kieran and all of that. But like that love story, the Julia Roberts thing is just tacked on in there for entertainment value.
Yeah, the
but there's a lot of accuracies in it. The Harry Boland kind of... thing that that was a love triangle. All
that's
of that
kind
is,
of what I was thinking
is
about.
Rubbish. But there is a lot of things in that film that are very accurate.
It's got Liam Neeson.
Yeah, so I would put that on a list of accurate because I would use that as a teacher to teach my class about Michael Collins. Absolutely, I would. Now you'd have to point out what we always do is get a useful exercise is getting them to research what are the historical inaccuracies in the film, and there are inaccuracies in it. Absolutely, but no, I think it's pretty good.
Okay.
Alexander is pretty
oh powerful. God, I forgot about Colin that. Farrell. That's Colin Farrell with his
again. There's
hair.
It's very hard though because Alexander just led this incredibly long military career. So like, there's a lot of things that we don't know about him.
Angelina Jolie's in that one.
She is. She's his mom, right?
His mommy.
She's his mom.
I'm trying to think of more. I'm like Shrek.
Shrek is very historic.
Shrek probably came out the same year as Jesse James. That's what happened. Or Shrek 2, maybe.
Yeah, I wanted to actually preface what I said by saying this, that there were so many more films I could have added to the inaccurate list. Like, but I just picked the ones that I kind of thought were
Pearl Harbor
were the best
gym
ones.
In that one now.
Oh my God.
I can't even think straight anymore.
Oh my God.
It's painful. Yeah. Don't watch it. Beautiful films like Letters from Iwo Jima, maybe, or or Flags of Our Fathers, maybe just the depiction of the.
I was thinking that you get the two sides to that, and actually, Iwo Jima is the better of the two of those, I think. Anyway,
Clint
I think
Eastwood, isn't it?
Yeah, to be fair to old Clint, they're good movies.
Good man, Clint
good
yourself.
Yeah,
great job, Clint. Fair play to you. I wonder, did he get any rewards for those?
I think he did.
Tigerland's a good film. I don't know if you've seen that one. That's with Colin Farrell.
Oh, that's with Colin Farrell. Mm. Yeah, that is good.
It's
that's
good
quite
depiction
good.
About the whole, I suppose, just the glorification of going to war. Like he, you know, his character is like, hell no, I don't want to go to war.
I've only seen Tigerland once. Mm.
It's good.
Yeah.
Again, kind of mundane in many ways, but it's fairly accurate, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's based on an actual event. That character, is he real? I think he disappears in it, doesn't it, towards the conclusion.
Spoiler.
Oh, I mean, he lives like... on a boat and Morgan Freeman catches up with him after he does some jail time in Shawshank. Yeah, that's what happened. Oh, I mean, so, I hope you all haven't seen that film either.
Yeah, no, I think when it comes to, you want to know that the film you're watching is some bit historically accurate, because if you feel things for the character, you want to know that they're kind of justified, that you were like, I don't know, maybe that's because we're both historians and maybe some people just don't care. Like, they're like, it's entertainment. You give it, take or leave it.
We care, people. There are people out there that believe Jack Dawson was a real man. But he exists now
only in our memories. Oh, such
it's
a cool.
It's been 84 years.
Such a gem of a movie. What so gem. Terribly written in terms of its script. But I don't care. I don't care.
I bought it on YouTube. That's how much I loved it. Just kept it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Still not out on Netflix. And James Cameron, I think, is the third person to get down into the Mariana Trench. Believe it or not. Yeah. Third explorer down into the Mariana Trench. Could you imagine that?
I could not.
I wouldn't go down there if you paid me, well, maybe $1 million. But, you know,
let's crowdfund. Yeah.
Please, I'll set up a Patreon, send fee to the Mariana Trench in a little submarine.
Oh, I'll just stay on the ghost
thing. You can come with me. You're coming.
Thanks.
If I go down.
You're coming with me.
I jump, you jump, remember?
Wait, is there any film on that list you haven't seen?
I haven't seen in a long time now, Schindler's List, Alexander.
Schindler's List is just very hard to watch. It's tough. Like, it's a tough one.
As in, I remember being quite, as in, it's not a horror, you know, I usually can watch a film on my own, but not horror movies. But I watched Schindler's List on my own and I was like petrified of Ralph Fiennes. I was terrified of his character.
He is a great actor. He's a great actor.
If there was ever a definition for evil, I mean, it's such a subjective word and it's such a kind of a word that kind of applies to a spectrum. But my God, his depiction in that as a Nazi, as just, this is not the norm. You know, this is normal behavior.
Well, that's it.
That's what's terrifying. Yeah,
what's terrifying about it. And that's why I think those films are more accurate, because they're not. They're not painting them as like psychopaths. They're painting them as normal people.
This was the way they lived. Yeah. And I think what's very incredibly sad in that film is just the... Is it the little girl with a red coat or something? Yeah,
it's very famous.
Nah, I can't watch that, you know?
Oh God, we need to...
Once is enough.
Not talk about it
Let's
now.
Talk about Shrek 3, and I'm joking. Shrek. What about Jaws again? Bring it back to Jaws.
Jaws is just...
What a show.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's that's an amazing piece of research.
Probably the top 10. I'm trying to think of like favorite film. Jaws, around it, yeah.
Jaws ain't in my top 10, but it's there somewhere.
Maybe, yeah, maybe not my top 10.
Maybe,
but it's
top
there.
30.
Oh, it's definitely in my top 30.
Top 30 hits, y'all remember? What a show.
The Shining would be up there.
Ooh. I like that.
Yeah, Shining's incredible.
Yeah, there's some amazing films out there, absolutely. And I think any of those films, if you have not watched them, please.
Recommend Spotlight.
Spotlight, I haven't watched it yet.
Prepare yourself, because it's tough to watch, but it's incredible. And also, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. It's just
beautiful. As you said, I remember the cinematography where he's crossing this kind of cold, icy kind of lake. Or the snowland, just beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. That's
real
exactly
disconnect. You know what I mean?
In Missouri, and like, yeah, it's really nice. Okay, I'm gonna just. This has just been so like self-indulgent. I'm just gonna talk about
not
films
at all.
I think.
I think people deserve to know this. I think there's a lot of there are people out there that are looking for recommendations. You know, like
true.
We're regurgitating and watching the same. Well, we're not regurgitating, but you know what I mean, figuratively.
I always recommend as well. Even though it's not really historically accurate at all, but it's just a beautiful film. Life is Beautiful. La Vita è Bella. Another great film that I insist on forcing on my classes as well. like, if you're in transition year and I'm teaching it, you're watching it. And it's as simple as that.
A bit of advice. We know when you're trying to do the 1,000 yards there. If you're all listening, we know when you're doing it. Because I learned how to do it myself when I was in class. I used to mime sing. You know, when we'd have to sing in choir and I'd mime along with the rest of the class singing. Because I didn't want to sing. But the teacher knew.
I was the opposite, because this is just so me. I was like, I'm going to sing.
No, I was like,
so loud.
I'm just moving my mouth along with you. And then the teacher would come up close to the front of the line because I was at the front of the line because I was small.
And you'd be like,
ah. Yeah, I was just whispering it, kind of, you know, just sing whispering. It's terrible. Yeah, I hope that teacher.
I was in choir. We had some bangers. Great crack.
Maniac 2000.
So you walked out crossing into that night. Okay, we're going to have to go because it's an hour and 10 minutes in. And we've just been babbling. We're back to work soon.
Oh my goodness me.
We'll be back to our regular schedule, the podcast, on Sundays.
Fun days.
And if you're still listening, could you please rate the podcast? It helps us so much. It really helps push the podcast up in the charts and things. Mm-hmm, and so if you have an Apple account, rate us on Apple Podcasts, or if you have a Spotify account,
now you can rate us.
Rate us on that.
Pretty please.
And if you're feeling super nice, you could rate us on both.
I think there are a lot of super nice people out there.
I think there are too.
This isn't manipulation. this is totally reverse psychology.
Okay.
Do it now.
Now. Well, this was a bucket of fun.
Yes.
We'll be back Sunday, so?
On the first Sunday of the new year, just for you.
Is it the first Sunday of the new year?
No, but I just made that up on the spot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the
first second
Sunday.
Sunday of the new year.
Second Sunday of the new year.
We should be accurate.
We will.
Okay. Okay, everybody, guys. Thanks so much for listening. We love you all.
Bye.
Bye.